I forgot to, oops, that holds it. Okay, so still the Hammond postulate applies that if you have a very exothermic reaction, the true geometries, right, which would have specific energies that you could calculate by quantum mechanics, are going to be near those of the starting material. So even though we're not displaying those explicitly along this x-axis, they really are similar. And so the factors which influence the energy would be similar to those that influence the energy of the starting material. Okay? So whatever factors made blue and red different, they were the same in the starting material and the transition state here. So you don't see a difference between red and blue. Whereas when the transition state comes later on, there's a difference between the starting material and the transition state between red and blue. So it's manifest in different rates or selectivity. Okay. So the difference in energy of activation, that's what this double dagger, there's an interesting story about the double dagger. Professor Eyring, who was at Princeton in the 1930s when he had these ideas about transition state theory and so on, wrote on in his manuscript, what he wrote was a star for a G. To mean the energy difference between the starting material and the transition state. But his the secretary misinterpreted that and wrote a double dagger. So from then on, it was a double dagger for that. And it's hard to find it. I couldn't find it. I got this other symbol, whatever it is. It's not truly a double dagger. But he called it by the name of his secretary. He called it the something or other mark. I forget what her name was. So anyhow, the double dagger refers to energies of the transition state relative to the starting material. So the rate constant, as we've said, is 10 to the 13th times at room temperature minus 3/4 delta G double dagger, which says that you get the difference in the activation energy, this delta G double dagger, you get it from measuring the rate. Right, if you measure the rate, you have the act. It's just two different ways of measuring, of reporting the same experiment, whether you report it in a rate constant or whether you report it as a free energy of activation. Okay, so there's our reaction, and we measure its rate and get the free energy of activation. Now suppose we make a change in the material, put an extra methyl group in or something like that, and we have a second reaction, so a different energy of activation. Now, there's a certain difference in those energies of activation, right? So a delta G, the black delta refers to the difference between starting material and transition state. The red delta refers to the difference between two different transition states, two different reactions that are competing, say, with one another. Okay, now, if you want to know the relative rates of the two, how fast is one compared to one the other, that, you see, you get by subtracting in the exponent. You know, that's what you can do with exponents. So that the relative rates are 10 to the minus 3/4 of the delta G double dagger. So if you put some reagent in and have it possible to react with two different reagents and measure at the end how much product you got from one and how much product you got from the other and look at the ratio of those two, that ratio tells you what the difference in the activation energies was, this delta G double dagger. So delta G double dagger is relative reactivity, and that's the same as selectivity. And notice, incidentally, that because of the temperature down here, if you do this at real high temperature, this is going to approach the exponent approaches zero, and this approaches one, and the rates will become equivalent. Right, so rates will tend to converge if you operate at high temperature. So if you want to make a reaction more selective, typically you run at a lower temperature. Right? So you increase discrimination by lowering the temperature. Now let's look at a specific example of reactivity and selectivity in terms of halogenation of propane. So you know the mechanism, we've talked about it many times, where the halogen atom abstracts a hydrogen atom from the propane and gives a free radical. But there are two different kinds of hydrogens it could abstract. It could abstract a hydrogen from methyl, a primary hydrogen, or the hydrogen from methylene, the secondary hydrogen. Once you've abstracted that hydrogen, then you've determined what ultimate product you're going to get. Because that radical, the n-propyl or the isopropyl radical, is going to abstract X from X2 from the halogen and become the corresponding halide. So the product is determined in the first step, taking the hydrogen off, not in the second step where you add the halogen. Now, in the case of chlorine, there's a 43% yield of n-propyl chloride and a 57% yield of isopropyl chloride, so it's close to 50-50. Does that mean that the ease of attacking a primary and a secondary hydrogen are very, very, very similar, you know, within a few, within 15 or 20% of one another? No, because there's a statistical factor, too. Can you see what that is? Yeah. What's it?
There's a factor of two favoring n-propyl.
Why? Why a factor of two? You can take it off of either end, but it's even more than that. It's a factor of three, not a factor of two. Can you see why? There's six primary hydrogens that could be attacked, but only two secondary hydrogens. So if you're interested in how fast you attack a hydrogen, you should correct this ratio by that factor of three if you want to know per hydrogen how easy is it to react. So there's a correction for the number of primary and secondary hydrogens. You need to divide that one by three because there are three times as many of those hydrogens as there are of the other. So if you divide 43 by three, you get about 14, and the ratio is 57 to 14, or 4 to 1, roughly. So it's four times as easy to pull off a secondary hydrogen as to pull off a primary hydrogen with chlorine. Now, suppose we did the same thing with bromine. And we could, as again, if we have relative rates, that's the same as the difference in activation energy. The difference in activation energy turns out to be 0.8 kilocalories per mole. Now we do it with bromine. And now it's much more selective. Right? Bromine really, really prefers to go at the secondary hydrogen. Already in chlorine, it was 4 to 1. But now, it's 35 to 1, almost 10 times as selective. Right? Oh, and furthermore, the reaction has to be done at 330 degrees. The reaction doesn't happen practically at room temperature. It's very slow. So you have to go to twice room temperature in order to get the reaction to go efficiently. That means, so this is a much slower reaction. Do you remember what the idea of the reactivity-selectivity principle was? Right? The more reactive, the less selective. Right? So bromine is much less reactive. You have to go to twice the temperature to have it work efficiently. But it's much more selective, too. So less reactive means more selective. Okay? And if we do the same trick here, we figure out that the difference in activation energy is 4.5 kilocalories per mole for bromine between whether it attacks the primary or the secondary hydrogen. So bromine shows much greater selectivity despite the fact that it's happening at higher temperature. Right? Remember, other things being equal, the higher temperature, the less selectivity you're going to get. That's what we just mentioned in the last slide. So, but despite the fact you're operating at higher temperature, it's more selective. Of course, that's a little bit messed up because the reason you're operating at higher temperature is because it's a slower reaction and therefore more selective. Let's look at pictures to see how that works out. Okay, so... here we'll look at the energies first involved. So we're breaking the CH bond, which is 101.1 kilocalories per mole, and forming HX, depending on which halogen atom is doing the abstracting. So if we take off a primary hydrogen, the one from the methyl group, it's going to be downhill in energy in the case of fluorine, slightly downhill in the case of chlorine, but uphill in the case of bromine and iodine. If we're going after a secondary hydrogen, you have the same trend. But now let's use these data in the case of chlorine. So it's going to be 2.1 kilocalories or 4.6, primary or secondary. And in the case of bromine, which we're going to compare with chlorine, 13.6 and 11.1. So now we can use those numbers to make this graph. So in the case of chlorine here on the left, we're attacking propane. Right, so we're starting at this energy, and we can either pull off a primary hydrogen here to generate that radical. That's going to be 2.1 kilocalories downhill in energy. Green means down here. Or we can pull off the middle hydrogen here, one of the secondary hydrogens, and that's going to be 4.6 down in energy. Or if we're using bromine instead, it's a harder reaction to do. It's uphill in energy. Right? And in the case of pulling off the primary hydrogen, it's going to be up to there. And in the case of the secondary hydrogen, it's up to there. Of course, the difference between these two is precisely the same as the difference between these two. That's the energy difference between those two radicals, the primary and the secondary radical. Okay, so this one is obviously more reactive. The chlorine is more reactive, and the bromine is less reactive. That's the reason you have to operate it at high temperature. Right? But the first one then is less selective. There's not much difference in the activation energies, and therefore the ratio of the two reactions is closer to one. Remember, it was four. And in the other case, it's much more selective, much bigger difference in the transition states. So in the first case, the ratio of rates was just a factor of four on a per hydrogen basis. And in the second case, it was almost 10 times that much, 35. Okay, and the difference in free energy of activation was 0.8 in the first case, and 4.5 in the second case, expressing the same ratio with a different number. So again, more reactive, less selective. Okay, now if we look at this in a little more detail, it's interesting. So at the transition state, the difference in energy between the two is 4.5 kilocalories per mole. Right. In the product, the difference between the two reaction paths is 2.5 kilocalories per mole. Why did I put an exclamation point on that? Can you see why this is different from the assumptions we were making earlier? How much difference was there very early? No difference. Right? How much difference was there at the end of the reaction coordinate? 2.5 kilocalories per mole. What do you expect as you go along the reaction coordinate? Brian? You think it would be at least monotonic, right? It should start with nothing, and then as you get more and more resonance stabilization or hybridization change or whatever it is that's making the two reactions different, as you go along, the hypothesis is that you start with a certain difference and you end with a certain difference, and in between you have some more or less steady change in the difference. But what happens in this case? The difference is bigger at the transition state than it is in the product. Right? It's not following this steady progression from starting material to product that reason suggested to us should apply. So how can the transition states be more different than the products are if you're only part way to whatever is going to be happening in the product? So one can make arguments trying to learn from this. For example, at the transition state, the hydrogen is, let's say, halfway across, partway across, between where it started on the R and where it ended on the BR. So we could draw resonance structures where the hydrogen is either bonded to R or bonded to BR, and then we'd say at the transition state there's resonance between these two structures. There are two different ways of drawing it. But maybe there's something else that's going on in the transition state as well. maybe you can have an important resonance structure which has R plus and Br minus, so a third resonance structure at the transition state, that the electrons will not be symmetrically distributed along this. Now, once you go on to the product and the H is attached to Br, then you can't have HBr minus and R plus. Right? At that stage, the electrons have found where they're going to go. There'll be an electron on the R for a radical, and the HBr will be neutral. So this is a kind of stabilization, this polarization, that you could have in the transition state that you can't have in the starting material, and you can't have in the product. So there's something special that happens halfway along that isn't present either at the starting material or product that can make the reaction unusually stable. So this polar character in the transition state may be an important factor. And it's true that secondary cations are much more stable than primary cations. And we'll be talking about that in nauseating detail shortly, so don't worry about not having talked about it yet. But it's true. So that this R plus in one case is a secondary cation, and in the other case is a primary cation. So this could be a big difference at the transition state that applies only at the transition state, not in either the starting material or the product. So something special could be going on here. Yeah. I suppose that it's conceivable that if this were sufficiently stabilizing, it's not true. But it's not a silly thing to suppose. What we're doing is this, right? And we're just saying as we go from starting material to product, there are various factors that influence the stability of things. But there's one factor, namely this ionic character, that applies only at the transition state and can make a difference between whether it's primary or secondary at that stage. Now, what you're saying is if that could be sufficiently stabilizing, it might do this. See if I can do it, right? And then in the middle, you'd have an intermediate. Professor Bartlett in a lecture once said something I thought was interesting, which is the difference between a transition state, which is this, and an intermediate, which is this. He didn't do stupid things like this, right? But the difference between a transition state and an intermediate is the difference between up and down, right? An intermediate is something which in principle has a lifetime. If you had a low enough temperature, you could isolate this species, maybe at liquid helium temperature, you could take a spectrum of it. See what I mean? But this you can't take a spectrum of halfway across because it has no lifetime at all, no matter how low the temperature. Okay? Good. Okay, so this is a warning sign in applying the Hammond's postulate logic to understanding reaction rates. Sometimes there are factors involved in stabilizing transition states that are different from those in either starting material or product, and then you can't assume that there'll be some sort of steady progression as you go from starting material to product in explaining things. So there's another kind of chain reaction besides this substitution of halogen for hydrogen. You can have addition to an alkene that involves free radicals. For example, you can have a free radical X which adds to a carbon-carbon double bond to give a carbon radical. This carbon radical can then take H away from HX, like that. So you've added H and X to the carbon-carbon double bond using this same kind of cyclic machinery that we saw in the substitution reaction, or at least something that's very close to that. Now let's see about the practicality of doing this reaction in terms of bond dissociation energies. We start with bond energies. We start with X And the carbon-carbon double bond, and also there happens to be XH around. And we end with the XH having added to the carbon-carbon double bond, an X around that then goes back and starts over again. So we can look at the energies involved here. The carbon-carbon double bond energy at the beginning is 146 kilocalories per mole. At the end, the carbon-carbon bond, the single bond, is 83, and the carbon-hydrogen bond is 99. So we've lost 146, gained 83 and 99, and we also change XH to XC. So the XC in the case of fluorine, the RX is 116 and the HX is 135. So if we take what we've lost is 146 and the HX 135, and what we've gained, which is 83 and 99 and the 116 from the RX bond, and add them together, we find that this is exothermic by 17 kilocalories per mole. So equilibrium tells us that this is a good thing to do. Okay, so there it is, 17 kilocalories down. So it looks fine from the point of view of equilibrium. Now let's check it with the other halogens. All the other halogens are about the same and not very different from the fluorine. Right, so all of them look equally plausible from the for purposes of the overall change in energy. However, this is a stepwise reaction. You remember the machine goes in two steps. So for the machine to run efficiently, both steps have to be fast. So let's look at the individual steps in the reaction. It turns out that this reaction, although it's equally plausible for all the halogens in terms of overall energy change, only works in the case of bromine. It doesn't work with fluorine, chlorine, or iodine. Okay, so here's the intermediate where we've got the CC single bond but haven't formed the others yet. Okay, so that's quite... exothermic because we formed XC and we've lost, what, 63 kilocalories per mole in going from the double bond to the single bond for the CC, but we've gained the XC, which is worth, in this case, 135 kilocalories per mole in the case of fluorine. So that's way downhill in energy. So that's a very fast reaction. No problem with that one. Now, in the case of chlorine, you're losing the same double bond to single bond, 63, but you're gaining only 103, so it's not so exothermic. Bromine is only slightly exothermic, and iodine is endothermic. So that first reaction is going to be slow for iodine. Okay, so that X's it out. Now, why not say, well, we'll just wait. It'll be slow, but we'll just wait till it happens. It's because other things can happen instead. Okay, and we'll see that very shortly. So if it's uphill, forget it. Okay, now we have to do also the second reaction in the step. And in the case of fluorine, that's way uphill. So that doesn't work. And chlorine is uphill also. Bromine is downhill. Right, and of course iodine is downhill, but bromine is the only one that's downhill in both steps, so that both steps can be fast going around that cycle. Only HBr works fast enough in both steps. Now, there's not only the question of whether the overall reaction can happen, but what's called regiospecificity. But I guess we'll have to do that one next time. Okay. Oh, incidentally, there won't be a lecture on Monday, as you know, and we still haven't got a second TA in the course. I hope that we'll get one soon. I mean, Eugene does a great job, but he maybe can't handle it single-handed. So there won't be one Monday evening either. But I'm hoping we'll have somebody soon to do the second discussion section. Question? Pardon me? Sunday night there'll be the regular TA. I've requested the room. I'll let you know what it is. Is Nathan here still? He's examining. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, no, yeah.